This is the last night that we are going to be talking about the in-between time. That is the time between Malachi and Matthew. I know that there are those who have really enjoyed this study, but I suspect that for some it's been almost painful going through some of this stuff. And honestly, for me, a lot of the stuff I had to wade through was painful. The reason we did that is because the things that we are looking at set the stage for the advent of the gospel, the time of Jesus when he came into the world and the gospel first began to be preached. Also, the reason we were looking at this is because it really impacts the formation of the canon of the scripture. Now, in looking at this time period, we kind of divided it into two. First, we emphasize the political situation. By the time you get down to the days of Christ, we understand that with Pompey, the Romans took control of that part of the world. And by the time Jesus comes, the Jews are under a Roman procurator in Jerusalem. He is in charge of who's going to be high priest. So the high priest is appointed by the Romans, and he's in control of the temple. And the Jews, in theory, respect the priesthood and respect the temple. And then on the other hand, they also respect the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin is mostly the Pharisees, and they have much of the control of the synagogues. So if you are Jewish at that point in time, you can look at the temple or you can look at the synagogues, and you understand that no matter what direction you go, there has been some corruption there. So there is the political situation, and then there is the literature of that time period. And this is the part that to us that really is most interesting, at least it is to me. And there are certain things that we've tried to emphasize. We've emphasized that there has never been a time that the people of God had not or didn't have to watch out for frauds. That was true in the days of Moses. That was true in the days of the prophets. We read in the book of Jeremiah of some false prophets who were writing letters even back then. It was true in the days of the Apostle Paul. It was true when Muhammad wrote the Quran. It was true when Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon. There was never a time when the people of God did not have to watch for frauds. Now, that was true in the in-between time. If we talk about the books that didn't make the cut, the books that did not make it into the Old Testament, the ones that didn't make the cut didn't make the cut for two basic reasons. Number one, their timing. We remember the statement of, if I can get us there, the statement of Josephus, it is true our history hath been written since Artaxerxes very particularly, but hath not been esteemed of the like authority with the former by our forefathers, because there hath not been an exact succession of prophets since that time. His statement, really, Artaxerxes, that's the cutoff. Artaxerxes was the king of Persia in the days of Malachi. So he really sets the time. After that, we did not have an exact succession of prophets. And that kind of thinking was even written into the Apocrypha, which is funny to me. Should the Apocrypha be in there? The guys that wrote the Apocrypha made statements pretty much saying, yeah, we're on board with what Josephus said about it. And one thing we tried to emphasize last week, up until the time of Malachi, if we wonder, were they just arbitrarily throwing books into the Old Testament? Did they have a living succession of prophets up until the time of Malachi? That being the case, there's not a whole lot to worry about there. Now, timing and content. And content is what we were really talking about last week. If we take a book like 1 Maccabees, well, why do we look at 1 Maccabees and say pretty good history, but you know it really isn't scripture? You look at some of the statements in 1 Maccabees. Stored the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill until a prophet should come to tell what to do with them. So there was great distress in Israel, such it had not been since the time that prophets ceased to appear among them. Did the writer of 1 Maccabees recognize we don't have a prophet here? They knew that. If we look at 2 Maccabees, which we looked at last week, and to me, 2 Maccabees is funny. When our ancestors were being led captive to Persia, the pious priest of that time took some of the fire of that altar and secretly hid it in the hollow of a dry cistern. You have just some fantastic tales being told. Jeremiah hid the ark, the altar, and the tent on the Mount of Moses. But then finally, when you get to the end, 2 Maccabees 15:38, very end of the book. If it is well told and to the point, that is what I myself desired. If it is poorly done and mediocre, that's the best I could do. Does that sound like a thus saith the Lord? The writer understood. You know, I'm pretty much writing what is a pretty mediocre history here. We come to a book like Tobit, some of the things we saw in Tobit. You got Tobit, who in this book says that he was a young man at the time the house of Israel left the family of David behind, which would have been 931 BC, and he's still around when the Assyrians conquer them. How many years is that? That's over 200 years. Whoever wrote that had no real concept of the amount of time that was involved from the split of the kingdom down to the coming of the Assyrians. And then you have, I forgot about Judith. 12th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled over the Assyrians in the great city of Nineveh. By the way, that okay was kind of a graphic tale told at the end of the book. You have all these things in the Apocrypha that you look at and say, wow. Baruch, these are the words of the book that Baruch wrote in Babylon when the Chaldeans took Jerusalem and burned it with fire. What's the problem with that statement? He wasn't in Babylon. When you read the last part of the book of Jeremiah, he was there with Jeremiah in Jerusalem, and he was taken with Jeremiah to Egypt. So there are a lot of things in the Apocrypha that, to use an old expression, betray the cloven hoof. Wherever they came from, they did not come from inspired writers. Now, we've looked at some of these things. Okay, what do we have left? We've looked at some of the wisdom literature, the history, and finally, the last books we just titled fantasy. And we only have about three of them left up there. They're interesting. They're funny. Sometimes they have a good moral to them, but they're kind of ridiculous, to tell you the truth. For instance, you see Susanna, look at the second one, the story of Daniel and Susanna. Let's go there for just a second. I tell you to turn there in your text, but I know you can't. So this is one of those days where I'm going to have to do a little bit of reading. I have some stuff to put up on the screen, but some of this you'll just have to listen to. Now, the story of Daniel and Susanna. Okay, when you hear the name Daniel, who do you think of? Daniel, Prophet Daniel. And that's exactly the one we're talking about here in this story. All right. There was a man living in Babylon whose name was Joachim. He married the daughter of Hilkiah, named Susanna, a very beautiful woman and one who feared the Lord. Her parents were righteous and had trained their daughter according to the law of Moses. Joachim was very rich and had a fine garden adjoining his house. The Jews used to come to him because he was the most honored of them all. That year, two elders from the people were appointed as judges. Concerning them, the Lord had said, wickedness came forth from Babylon, from elders who were judges who were supposed to govern the people. These men were frequently at Joachim's house, and all who had a case to be tried came to them there. When the people left at noon, Susanna would go into her husband's garden to walk. Every day the two elders used to see her going in and walking about, and they began to lust for her. They suppressed their consciences and turned away their eyes from looking to heaven or remembering their duty to administer justice. Both were overwhelmed with passion for her, but they did not tell each other of their distress, for they were ashamed to disclose their lustful desire to seduce her. Day after day they watched eagerly to see her. One day they said to each other, "Let us go home, for it is time for lunch." So they both left and parted from each other, but turning back they met again. And when they pressed the other for the reason, they confessed their lust. Then together they arranged for a time when they could find her alone. That's almost like the Three Stooges. You know, you stop and you think of the nature of the story that you're reading. It's a more serious topic than anything you'd see on the Three Stooges, but it is almost comical. You have two wicked elders, both lusting for Susanna, and they said, "Let's go home for lunch," and when they both snuck back to watch her, they run into each other and form a plan. This story is going to remind you a little bit of Naboth's Vineyard. Also remind you of an old movie called Strangers on a Train. If anybody remembers that, you may not. Now, if we were to continue reading in verses 15 through 44, there is a court sequence. Because what happens is these two elders sneak back into the garden, and when she goes into the garden, she sends all her servants out, and she's got a bathtub there, and she's taking a bath, and they burst in on her, and they say, if you won't be with us, we're going to say we found a young man in here and have you killed. And she says a few words and say, "Well, I'm not going to do it. You're just going to have to kill me." So the judges drag her into court. And let me see if I wrote a few things down here. Nope, not it. What happens? They take her into court and they give testimony against her, and she is condemned to death. But then a young man named Daniel stands up. "The Lord heard her cry. Just as she was being led off to execution, God stirred up the Holy Spirit of a young lad named Daniel, and he shouted with a loud voice, 'I want no part in shedding this woman's blood.' All the people turned to him and asked, 'What is this you are saying?' Taking this stand among them, he said, 'Are you such fools, O Israelites, as to condemn a daughter of Israel without examination and without learning the facts?'" So you got a young man, Daniel. He says, "We can't do this. You let me take these two guys and examine them independently, and we'll just find out what the facts are." So they took the two judges, they put one over here and they put one over here, and Daniel goes and talks to the first one, and he says, "Okay, when you caught her laying with this young man that you're talking about, what kind of tree were they under?" And he says, "A mastic tree." And so he goes to talk to the other judge and says, "When you found her with this young man, what kind of tree were they under?" And he says, "An evergreen oak." So they know they're lying. So they execute the two judges instead of Susanna. All right, that's the story. Now, it's not as bad as some of the other stories. And it does have a good moral tale to it. But there are a lot of good moral tales that don't belong in the scripture. Now, when you read this story, for instance, as it starts out, you find her husband Joachim was very rich and had a fine garden. Does that bring up any questions in your mind? Daniel is spoken of as a young lad, so it's just when he went into Babylonian captivity. At the very beginning. At the very beginning, if you're taken into Babylonian captivity, how in the world do you get to be rich and have a fine garden? Did the Babylonians just leave you your money? I don't think they worked that way. Now, as you go forward in the story, that year there were two elders from the people who were appointed as judges. again, this is the beginning of the Babylonian captivity in accordance with the facts that we know. When the Babylonians brought them from Judah, did they say, okay, you're going to be an autonomous group and we're going to let you set up your own judges? In verse 41, because they were elders of the people and judges, the assembly believed them and condemned her to death. Again, do you think they could do that in Babylon? In the days of the Romans in Judah, did the Romans allow the Jews to execute people, or did they have to come to them? In the same book, verse 62 at the very end, acting in accordance with the law of Moses, they put them to death. Thus, innocent blood was spared that day. Again, you stop and you think about this. If those judges were appointed by the Babylonians, how in the world would you execute them according to the law of Moses? And if they were appointed by their own people, how in the world would they get the authority to execute anybody? When you look at these stories, even though they might have a fairly decent moral, there's enough in there historically that just looks fishy, that makes you wonder where it came from. I'll tell you what it sounds like to me. Everybody turn over to Luke chapter 2. We're going to use a Bible reference. Just because after a while, unless we use a Bible reference, I get really uncomfortable. Luke chapter 2, and we're just going to refer to it. In Luke chapter 2, the single, probably most memorable thing to us is Jesus in the temple. How old is Jesus when he goes to the temple? How much information do we have on the life of Jesus from birth to 12? Big gap in there. Big gap. Do you know what some early people tried to do with that gap? They wrote stories about the childhood of Jesus. And some tried to pass them off as scripture. Now, for instance, one of the stories was Jesus playing with another kid, was playing with another kid that angered him. Jesus struck him dead. Would you have a problem with that story? I'd have a little problem with that story. But this is the kind of thing we confront. When people see gaps, they just kind of want to fill them up. And if they don't know what to put in the gap, they'll invent something. What we're reading here about the life of Daniel sounds a lot like some of that made-up stuff that they did with Jesus. Now, the next story. Oh, had a little more there. Oh, a little bias for Judah. Reading the 57th verse. This is how you've been treating the daughters of Israel. They were intimate with you through fear, but a daughter of Judah would not tolerate your wickedness. Ah, those girls of Israel, they're no good. But that Judah girl, you know, she is. It's just, you know, when you see some of this stuff, you think, I don't know about that. The next story, Bel and the Dragon. Or you might have a copy of the Apocrypha that says Bel and the Snake. This is the beginning. When King Astyages was laid to rest with his ancestors, Cyrus the Persian succeeded him in his kingdom. Daniel was a companion of the king and was the most honored of all his friends. Now the Babylonians had an idol called Bel, and every day they provided for it 12 bushels of choice flour and 40 sheep and 6 measures of wine. The king revered it and went every day to worship it, but Daniel worshiped his own God. So the king said to him, "Do you not think that Baal is a living God? Do you not see how much he eats and drinks every day?" This story kind of reminds you of the Ark of the Covenant in the house of Dagon. Now, when we start out here looking at Baal and the Dragon, we notice that Cyrus is just a great friend of Daniel. Don't know how that happened, But in theory, Cyrus is a great friend of Daniel, and Daniel is one of his chief companions. And they've got a little problem going on here in Babylon. And keep in mind that the action that we're looking at is represented as taking place in Babylon, which is a problem in and of itself. But when we look at what is happening here, the temple of Baal, every day, what do they furnish for Baal? And by the way, B-E-L is a corruption of B-A-A-L. Okay, so what are they furnishing every day for Baal to eat? 12 measures of choice flour. Don't know how much that is. Sounds like a lot to me when you stop and think, how many sheep? Well, I'm going to erase that and write bushels then, because I know what a bushel is. Maybe I know what a bushel is. 12 bushels. How many sheep? I don't know much about slaughtering sheep. How many people do you think you could feed for one meal with 40 sheep? Anybody know? Take one sheep, slaughter it. How many people do you think you could feed with that? Pardon me? Yeah. 40 sheep sounds like a lot of meat to me, to tell you the truth. Pardon me? Well, I'm wondering, you know, how much meat can you get off a sheep? I don't know. Sounds like a lot. How much wine? There's where the measure is. 6 measures. Don't know how much wine that is. I'm suspecting it's quite a bit. Okay, this is the problem. They furnish this to Baal every night and every morning. It's been consumed, and Cyrus is really impressed. Cyrus says to Daniel, boy, you have any doubts that Baal is a living God? Look how much he eats. All right, the story goes on. Daniel says Baal hadn't eaten anything. This is, you know, something's going on here. And so Cyrus gets all upset, and he says to the priest of Baal, he says, listen, we're going to have a contest. You know, you're going to prove that Baal's eating this stuff. And they say, okay, just seal up the temple. So the king put his seal on the temple so nobody could get in or out. But before he put the seal on the temple, Daniel snuck in and put ashes all over the floor. And then they sealed it so nobody could go in and out. And lo and behold, there was a secret passageway that the 70 priests used the secret passageway, and they brought their family in every night through the secret passageway to eat all the food, and in the morning it'd all be gone. But the next morning they went in, Daniel says, look at the floor, look at all the footprints. So they killed the priest of Baal. All right. I got some issues with that story. Issue number one, what's Cyrus doing in Babylon? You know, biblically or historically, Cyrus live in Babylon? Second issue, just look at this number, 70. 70 priests. All right, let's just say each of them had 2 wives and 4 kids, so they had 7 in a family. How many total people is that? 70 times 7. 490. I'm guessing that even with 490 people, that's a lot of food for them to sneak in, eat it, and sneak out, and nobody knows it. One of my favorite sayings, you've heard me say it, comes from my father. He says, if 2 people know something, it's not a secret. 490 people. Number one, I don't think they can eat that much every night. Number two, you think husbands, wives, and kids are going to keep that secret so that Cyrus doesn't know? And third, does anybody notice that these people are up all night and sleeping all day? Yes.
You went to Luke 2. What did you do with
it? All I was saying in Luke 2 was you have the story of Jesus. He's 12 years old. Birth, 12 years old. In between those events, there's nothing. So people started making up stories and sticking them in there. There's just a lot of problems with this story when you stop and you think about it. So the long and the short of it is after they kill all the priests, they've got this other god that Daniel has to deal with. This is the dragon. Now, like we say, some translations say snake, some say dragon. When I read that, I just think a dragon. What do they mean dragon? Do they mean like a Komodo dragon? Did they import something like that? I would have a hard time looking at that disgusting thing and thinking of it as a god. But if it's a snake, I would also have the same problem. Well, Daniel kills the dragon. And he does it by making a mixture of pitch and fat and hair. And he balls it all up and throws it to the dragon. The dragon eats it and explodes. Blows up. Let me get to that and read it a little. Now in that place there was a great dragon which the Babylonians revered. The king said to Daniel, "You cannot deny that this is a living God, so worship him." Daniel said, "I worship the Lord my God, for he is the living God. But give me permission, O king, and I will kill the dragon without sword or club." The king said, "I give you permission." Then Daniel took pitch, fat, and hair and boiled them together and made cakes, which he fed to the dragon. The dragon ate them and burst open. Then Daniel said, "See what you have worshipped." All right, that's the incident. Now in verses 28 and 29, when the Babylonians heard about it, they were very indignant and conspired against the king, saying, "The king has become a Jew. He has destroyed Baal and killed the dragon and slaughtered the priest. Going to the king," they said, "hand Daniel over to us, or else we will kill you and your household." The king saw that they were pressing him hard and under compulsion. He handed Daniel over to them. Anything about that strike you as odd? You think Cyrus is afraid of anybody? This is Cyrus, in theory. He has just conquered the Babylonians, and now he's going to be intimidated by the Babylonians, so he's going to hand Daniel over to them. Well, lastly, Daniel gets saved. They threw Daniel into the lion's den, and he was there for 6 days. Right now, this is funny. Stop and think about this. In the book of Daniel, Daniel in the lion's den, they throw him in, and, you know, it's really kind of at the beginning of the story, fairly close to it. Now here, Cyrus throws him in. That's also at the beginning of the story. You'd think they'd get tired of throwing him in a lion's den, wouldn't you? Or learn their lesson somehow. Now, when they threw him in the lion's den, fortunately for him, the prophet Habakkuk came to visit him. God had Habakkuk come and bring him dinner and tell him that everything was going to be okay. And so he survived the lion's den again, and everything turned out okay, and, you know, the good guys win. But, you know, when you start thinking about problems with some of these stories, again, Cyrus living in Babylon, how much did they eat every night? And how did they keep it a secret with that many people involved in it? The Babylonians had Cyrus where he felt like he was under compulsion. That's Cyrus. He is not afraid of anybody. And Habakkuk comes to feed Daniel lunch. Do the math on that. When did Habakkuk prophesy? Anybody have an idea? Everybody turn to the book of Habakkuk. As soon as you look at Habakkuk, it'll probably come back to you. What is the theme of the book of Habakkuk? Habakkuk is all upset because, why? Babylonians are coming. He doesn't think that's right. God, we don't think it's fair of you to use somebody worse than we are to punish us. How can you do this? And God says, they're coming. All right. If he is a prophet prophesying the Babylonian captivity, then that means he was prophesying before when? We'll just put 606 up here, which was when Daniel went into captivity. He is a pre-Babylonian prophet. Now, I'm going to guess he wasn't 12 years old. I'm going to guess he wasn't 20 years old, though he could have been. I'm going to guess, say, he's 30 years old. Just prime of life from a Jewish point of view. So in 606, Habakkuk is probably 30 years old. And now we're in the days of Cyrus after the Persians have conquered the Babylonians. So we know it's got to be later than. When did Cyrus conquer Babylon? 536. It's over 70 years. We don't know how far in advance of the Babylonian captivity Habakkuk prophesied. But the Babylonian captivity is 70 years before Cyrus takes over. Now this is after that. We're probably talking a good 80 years, depending on how old he was when he started. This is a 100-year-old guy we're talking about. You know, this there are just too many things in this story that don't add up. And such it is with a lot of these stories. Now, the last book we look at is 2 Esdras. And I'm going to make very little comment about 2 Esdras. This is the book that nobody really wanted. Got more criticism than almost any other. Believed by most people not even to have predated the beginning of the gospel. Now, if somebody said, how could that be? The oldest real copies of the Septuagint we have date from like 200 A.D., so there was room there for some funny business taking place, additions and such. But to see what we mean when we're talking about Esdras and the problem you get into. Now, 2 Esdras is supposedly apocalyptic literature. And what is, if you're in the Daniel class on Tuesdays, what is apocalyptic literature? It's a literary style characterized by fantastic symbolism, numbers, and angels. Now, 2 Esdras is kind of a knockoff of Daniel and the book of Revelation, believe it or not. Now, for instance, chapter 2 and verse 23. When you find any who are dead, commit them to the grave and mark it, and I will give you first place in my resurrection. Problem. In the Old Testament, you had passages that implied a resurrection from the dead. You had passages that did not imply a resurrection. That's why you had Pharisees and Sadducees. It involved proper interpretation. Most of the apocryphal books are not like that. They just come out and say, there's going to be a resurrection from the dead. There's going to be heaven and hell. And they lay it out pretty much like You know, they had it all figured out already, and they didn't. Chapter 6 and verse 42, on the third day you commanded the waters to be gathered together in a seventh part of the earth. Does anybody see a problem with that? According to 2 Esdras, the earth's surface, six parts land, one part water. How accurate is that? The earth's surface is what percent covered with water? Anybody know? 70%. Now that is not 6/7 land. But according to 2 Esdras, that's the proportion. All this I have spoken before you, O Lord, because you have said that it was for us that you created the world. Other nations, they are nothing. They are like spittle. God's purpose in creation was Jewish nation. It's all about them. Chapter 7 and verse 11, for I made the world for their sake, and when Adam transgressed my statutes, what had been made was judged. I made the world for them. If you know the teaching of the New Testament, what was God's eternal purpose? Ephesians 3, verses 8 through 12, the reason for the creation was God had a purpose, and the purpose was to manifest his wisdom in the heavenly realm through Jesus and the church. Israel was simply a footnote. It was a means to an end. That was the reason for that nation. If we keep going, went a little too far, didn't I? Oh, that's all I wrote down or put up there. A couple more to read you right quick. This is chapter 7 and verse 27. Everyone who has been delivered from the evils that I have foretold shall see my wonders. For my son, the Messiah, shall be revealed with those who are with him, and those who remain shall rejoice 400 years. After those years, my son, the Messiah, shall die, and all who draw human breath. Then the world shall be turned back to primeval silence for 7 days, as it was at the beginning, so that no one shall be left. My son, the Messiah, is going to come, and boy, things are going to be good for how long? 400 years. Then the Messiah is going to die, and everybody's going to die. Then we're going to go back to primeval silence. Interesting concepts. In chapter 14 and verse 9. For you shall be taken up from among humankind, and henceforth you shall live with my son and with those who are like you until the times are ended. The age has lost its youth, and the times begin to grow old. For the age is divided into 12 parts, and 9 of its parts have already passed, as well as half of the 10th part. So 2 of its parts remain besides half of the 10th part. I know that's subject to interpretation, but that sounds an awful lot like history is divided into 12 parts and we've already gone through 9.5 of them. Which means, according to this, we shouldn't be here now. You know, when you look at all of this stuff, like I say, Esdras was the one that nobody wanted. It almost looks like in 2 Esdras somebody sat down and grabbed some of what he thought was Christian stuff and some of what he thought was Jewish stuff and said, I'm going to write something that blows everybody's mind. Because there are people who behave that way. Now, as we kind of fade out on this, another thing to remember about the Apocrypha, not quoted in the New Testament. None of these books ever are. And one more thing. We're about out of time. difference between Old Testament canon and New Testament canon. Do a little racing. When you think about the revelation of the Old Testament, remember we have emphasized that it was a book that was compiled over 1,500 years, or really over 1,000 years. In Acts 3, you know, Peter talked about from Moses, Samuel, all their successors. So you got about a 1,000-year span there for a compilation. You got 1,000 years. Does that give a lot of time for frauds to try to work their magic? And then a 400-year gap, does that give a lot of time for frauds to try to work their magic? Long time. It's being compiled, but there is a succession of prophets up until the days of Malachi. Now we come to the New Testament. New Testament canon. How many books? This is not brain surgery. This is your grade school class. How many books in the Old Testament? 39 in the Old. How many in the New? Oh, by the way, I've noticed in classes, students are getting worse and worse at knowing the books of the Bible. I'll just throw that out there. All right. Now, Old Testament, 1,000 years. New Testament, how long to compile? Being a late dater, where the book of Revelation is concerned, we're still going to say 40 years. About 40 years. From about 50 up to 90. Now, in those 40 years, is there less time for frauds to try to work their magic? Much less time. Now, did that mean nobody tried? Well, they tried, and they're still trying. But similarity. Up until the days of Malachi, what did they have? Up until the revelation, what did they have? Key point to remember on that. There was always frauds. But when you look at the time elements that are involved, there was always somebody there. The frauds, honestly, are there people that if they were studious enough to do it, could come up with a fraud that looked pretty convincing? Are there writers who were that good that they could do it? Yeah, they could. Wouldn't make it scripture. And the point about the frauds, somewhere along the line, they betrayed themselves. Either by axe to grind, sticking in a false doctrine somewhere, or if you talk about motivation, when you look at false teachers historically, why do they do what they do? Lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, pride of life. Can you give me an example of somebody who tried to pass literature off as revelation from God for lust of the flesh reasons? Joseph Smith wanted to practice what? Muhammad came up with a revelation that said it was okay for him to have his son's wife, but not you. Lust of the eye. What's lust of the eye? Money. Is there any money in it? Mary Baker Eddy, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, once told all her followers that they all needed to buy a new copy of Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures because there was an added revelation. They bought the new copy, and there was one sentence: beware of malicious animal magnetism. But they all bought it. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, pride of life. What's pride of life? Prestige, status. Who gains status with, hey, I got a revelation from God? Muhammad did. Joseph Smith did. When you get to looking at the frauds, you can always trace it to either lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, pride of life. Thank you.